Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and I want to start the show with something that I kind of missed last week when I was talking, of course, about how Palestine is winning against Israeli apartheid. The struggle of resistance is really ramping up. You know, it's hitting Israel from multiple angles, tying its forces down, undermining its capabilities. But one of the key things that I guess Danny Haifong in last week's show did kind of touch on this, but the clip I really want to play today is by Richard Medhurst, a really great independent journalist. And he really talked about how, this clip, which I wanted to include last week, talked about how Israel's economy is just crashing. You know, that's partially from the blockade that Ansar Allah, which Yemen is enforcing in the Red Sea. And also by just companies pulling out. They don't want to take risks. They want to be there, you know. Also, their workforce. Migrant workers aren't coming. A lot of the Israeli workforce is tied up in the army now. You know, all these factors are just causing the Israeli army to tank. The army to tank, but also the economy to tank. And that's really what one of the things which is really causing Israel's war effort to just grind down increasingly. And that's something that's very important to keep in mind, you know, when we get depressed, when we think that this is just never ending, you know, things just aren't getting anywhere. No, things are progressing, you know, and the oppressor, the apartheid regime is looking increasingly fragile. So I want to start with that today. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm going to put that clip from Richard Medhurst on right now.
You guys recall that since October 7th, you have about 17% of the Israeli workforce that haven't come back to work, meaning they're all on benefits. You've got also a lot of the Palestinians that they used to use as basically slave labor, who would cross over from Gaza every morning and then go back to Gaza every night, or also in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, have to go and through a million checkpoints. They've kidnapped many of them and tortured them. Some of them were in detention for months. And so those Palestinians are also not coming into work anymore because of, you know, the apartheid system and this paranoia that they have. So Israeli businesses are nosediving and plummeting, and especially small businesses. So since October 7, you have 46,000 Israeli businesses that have been forced to close. So they're not just in trouble, they have utterly and completely shut down. Okay? So this is according to an Israeli newspaper, and they refer to Israel as a country in collapse, and this is being reported again by the Cradle. So they say this is a very high number that encompasses many sectors. About 77% of the businesses that have been closed since the beginning of the war, which make up about 35,000 businesses, are small businesses with up to 5 employees and are the most vulnerable in the economy. So that's according to one Israeli CEO who's being interviewed by the magazine. So the report also says that, quote, the most vulnerable industries are construction, and as a result, also the entire ecosystem that operates around construction, meaning ceramics, air conditioning, aluminium, building materials, and more. All of these significantly damaged. The trade sector has also been severely affected. This includes the service sector and industries like fashion, furniture, warehousing, entertainment, transport, tourism. Israel is in a situation where there is, quote, almost no foreign tourism. Adding that damage to businesses is all over the country and almost no sector has been spared. This includes agricultural sector, right? So you've got the primary sector, agriculture, industry, and then also services. So this includes agriculture, which is based mainly in the south and the north, both considered active combat zones due to the threat posed by the Palestinian resistance. So from the south, meaning from Gaza, and then the north, Galilee, or so near the Sea of Galilee and the Golan Heights, where it's Hezbollah. And you remember a lot of Thais were kidnapped on October 7th, you remember? So they, the Israelis have a shortage of people, right? The colony doesn't function. So they have to import workers or slave labor from Thailand and pay them cheap to work for them in agriculture and farming. I mean, look, to be honest, many countries do that. You have also seasonal things, like in Canada, they want people to pick apples in summer or whatever. But, what I was saying before about Palestinians especially is absolutely true. They use them like slave labor. In any case, the agricultural sector is impacted because of the combat zones. In addition to that, the total figure that they're saying is 60,000 Israeli businesses expected to shut down by the end of 2024. I mean, honestly, if you ask me, given the rate at which this is happening, I think it's going to be much more. You have to remember that you have Israelis leaving the colony entirely. You've got 500,000 at least who left by October, November. I think that was Times of Israel that reported that. That was 6 months ago, right? More than 6 months ago. 500,000 had left. I mean, Christ, it took the Algerians quite a while to kick out that many French. I can tell you, you had like 100,000 that left 1 month, and the next 200,000, 500,000 in one fell swoop. Wow. I mean, talk about decolonization. My goodness. But it goes to show you how easily they can leave and bring peace to the region by not stealing people's houses. They have that possibility. Palestinians got nowhere to go. You know why? Because they're Palestinian. They're not Polish. They're not Scottish. They're not Australian. They're not American. They're Palestinian. They come from Palestine and Palestine only. But, you know, the Israelis want to kick them out no matter what. And now they're being given a taste of their own medicine. Hezbollah's attacks have severely affected local business and education in the north. Tens of thousands of settlers have been forced to evacuate. I mean, again, that figure is very conservative. If you ask the Israelis, they'll tell you 80,000. The UN says 90,000, I think, or close to 100,000. I think the figure, if you ask me, and based on my reading, although, again, I don't have the exact source for you now, but the figure I have in my head was 300,000, and that's from a few months ago. And I think now, especially with Kiryat Shemona and all this talk about, oh my God, there's going to be a war with Lebanon, it's even more. Yeah. I mean, just 2 days ago, Hezbollah launched the biggest drones or aerial attack that they've ever launched against Israelis in the north. So they're evacuating more and more people because of these fires that are bursting out and popping up everywhere. They're uncontrollable fires. You have thousands of acres that are just burning to a crisp, and they can't put the fires out. So I expect it's more that it displaced. Again, these are not people that have left entirely, but they're displaced. So they've been put in hotels somewhere, towards the south or south of the Galilee. Hezbollah's leader, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, said just 4 days ago on the 10th of July, quote, "Our goal of draining the enemy's economy has been achieved." This is another domain that people don't think about. You know, I mean, I've always raised it to you because I think it's so significant and substantial because, you know, you can't have a colony functioning or any ecosystem functioning without the economy. It's the primary, it's the quintessential issue. It's the priority. You can't build an army without an economy. You can't have a public sector and civil service without an economy. You can't have anything without an economy. It's the basis upon which everything else is built, right? So if the colony's economy breaks down, it's a jackpot, bingo, you know? And they have been achieving that. And this is just a further indication of Israel's impending doom and crumbling. They're fleeing the colony entirely. They're displaced internally. The military sucks in Gaza. It sucks in the north. It can't stop the threats incoming barrages from Iran when they happen. It can't do anything. It's a complete failure. The Yemenis, we have to give them credit too, because remember, they've not only been choking the most southern port. Again, I'll pull up the map. I'll use it as a good opportunity to pull up a map. What is the Israelis' most southern port? It's Eilat, or as it's known in Arabic, before they changed the name like everything else in Palestine, Umm al-Rashrash. So it's right here on the Red Sea, okay? And it's on the way to the Suez Canal, okay? Now, the Yemenis, because Egypt are controlled by Israel and the United States and are not closing the Suez Canal, the only other option to choke traffic between the Mediterranean and the Red Sea is obviously here at the other closest point, which is the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Okay, this is the Bab el-Mandeb Strait between Yemen and the Horn of Africa. And of course, Yemen sits at the most strategic place of any, body. Land strip in a body of water. It's situated between the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, the Arabian Sea. If you just sail up the coast, now you're in Oman, of course, not Yemen, but if you just sail up there, you've got the Strait of Hormuz and, of course, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. It's utterly amazing. So they just decided to close the flow of traffic down here instead of up there, and they've achieved the exact same thing as in 1956, okay? So what they've done is no more ships come to Umm al-Rashrash or to Eilat. You can't get there. I mean, you can maybe come in from the Suez Canal, but what are you doing? You can't do anything if your traffic is meant to come from the other side, which is where a lot of the traffic from China, from all of the tigers and economic hubs in Asia, it's all coming this way. It's not coming the other way, right? It has to get from the Red Sea to the Mediterranean, not from the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. So you cut off traffic, you cut off supplies that the Israelis desperately need, and now they have to go all the way around Africa, and you've cost them time and money. So you're destroying their economy bit by bit just by diverting or cutting off the flow of maritime traffic through this very, very narrow and quite dangerous, actually, strait, which is very, very tight for navigation, right? So in any case, they've done that. And in addition, Yemen and Iraq together are striking the other ports in the Mediterranean. So there's no way to get around this. Even if you would sail around Africa and come back through the Gibraltar Strait and then into the Mediterranean, you're still screwed because Haifa is being struck. Ashdod down here is also being struck. Okay, this is one of their other ports, their other major ports. So all of the three major ones are being hit. Even the airport, you know, Ben Gurion getting hit sometimes. So they're doing these together, both Yemen and Iraq, sending their own drones. And again, it's remarkable the distance that they're traveling. Never mind that they're actually hitting also the targets accurately. It's absolutely incredible, this era that we've come into militarily and strategically. I mean, if you would have told me this a few years ago, I just wouldn't believe you. I wouldn't believe you that you know, these non-state actors would be choking off Israel's economy, or rather its maritime traffic, and thereby its economy. It's really amazing. And this is the solution when you have sellouts controlling Egypt and controlling Morocco, who refuse to close the Suez Canal and the Strait of Gibraltar, respectively. You manage another way, right? And this is how they're doing it. So just go back to the article. The Yemeni army's maritime operations have also contributed to the economy's downfall. Revenues at key ports, such as the southern port of Eilat, have fallen significantly, as I was saying. In the final months of 2023, the Israeli gross domestic product plummeted by nearly 20%. Jesus Christ. I mean, that is magnificent, really. That, you know, they destroyed Syria's economy. They destroyed Palestine. The Israelis and Americans have done this to so many people, and to see them get a taste of their medicine is so... Mwah. The threat of escalation with Hezbollah has also posed fears in Israel that any full-scale war with the Lebanese resistance will plunge the economy much deeper into the abyss. Hezbollah have demonstrated through recent video warnings that that they are capable of attacking energy infrastructure such as oil refineries and gas tanks. Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that's what the message was when they released that 10-minute video, the part one we were looking at a few weeks ago, where they you know, had 10 minutes of surveillance footage, nothing but surveillance footage, just to, like, you know, send the message that we can fly above your Haifa ports, your airstrips, your petrochemical storage facilities, and you won't even know that we're there. And if we can film from up there, we can bomb you from up there, and you're not going to even know about it till it happens. That's what the message was, okay? And the same thing, they released part two now with the Golan Heights. Like, you have this strategic base at the top of Jebel El Sheikh in the Golan Heights. It's not so protected and as secure right up there as you think it is. We can get to you up there as well. And we know every position of every facility, every radar station, all of it. All of the missile salvos, we've got it all on tape. Here it is for the whole world to see. So, but again, that's more focused on intelligence. I mean, just economically, man, what an achievement. I mean, you know, the Americans, like I said, the Americans and Israelis, they love sanctioning people and ripping their economies apart in Venezuela and Iran and everywhere. And now they get a taste of the medicine. It's karma. What do you want me to say? It's karma. And even then, it's not enough. It doesn't even come close. But really, this is why the Arabs, which I was saying in the documentary series that I made, the Arabs could control everything if they would team up. And I think that's been a strategic effort by the West, and they make no secret of it. It's not like, you know, I'm coming up with this myself. They have said this, you know, that they want to create like tiny enclaves across the Arab world. And that's what Israel is. That's what Lebanon is. It's like, oh, let's have a Christian country, an Arab Christian country here. We'll put the Jews over here. We'll put, you know, the Shias over here. Let's carve people up into like segregated sectarian communities, so that the Arab world is, instead of being connected from one end, from Oman to Morocco, as one body, which it is geographically and culturally and linguistically, now it's a bunch of, you know, different colonies and client states, and it's you know, divide and conquer, essentially. It's divide and conquer. And so this is, you know, just look at what Yemen are doing, what they're doing by cutting off the flow of traffic. This is what the Arabs could achieve threefold or fourfold if they would just cooperate. I mean, like I said, you've got the Strait of Gibraltar over here. You can cut off maritime traffic that way. You've got the Suez Canal over here. You can cut off traffic here as well. You've got the Bab el-Mandeb Strait down here, which the Yemenis have now sanctioned, and you've got the Strait of Hormuz over here. So, I mean, all of the strategic maritime, you know, pressure points pass through Arab countries, every single one of them. I mean, okay, the Panama Canal is also important, but we're not talking about that. And even then, it doesn't compare to the Suez Canal. I mean, it's not even, you know, the amount of traffic is much more important and higher throughout the Mediterranean and Red Sea and the Persian Gulf than it is anywhere else in the world. It's always been that way. So the fact that Yemen are able to cut off not just the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, but even the goddamn Indian Ocean. I mean, what times are we living in? It's truly unprecedented in every single way. And at this point, we're not even talking about the Palestinian resistance anymore. We're talking about the Yemenis, right? Who have just come out of a war, by Saudi Arabia, by the UAE. And how did that war come to an end? Do you all remember? It stopped. It really stopped when the Yemenis started bringing the war to the UAE's doorstep and Saudi Arabia's doorstep. Okay, and it wasn't too long ago. They fired drones at Aramco, at the largest Saudi oil company, set their fields ablaze during the Formula One race. What an embarrassment. And then they hit the UAE thousands of kilometers away, right? I mean, just a little over 1,000, right? So if you take the most conservative distance, because again, the Ansar Allah are not over here. They're in the areas of Sana'a, okay? So from here all the way to the UAE, I mean, we're looking at, 1,300 kilometers, right? That's unbelievable. And when they did that, and it was all the way in Dubai that they struck, right? So well over 1,000 kilometers. And sorry, it's created a bunch of points here. I don't know why. But the point is they started taking the war to their doorstep with this advanced weaponry, which they're using now against Israel. And then they learned their lesson and they cut the ball. So you see, it's been a long road to get here. It's taken a lot of time to get their stuff together, but they understand the tactics that need to be used and the long-term strategy, which is choke off the oil fields when it comes to Saudi Arabia and the UAE, prevent them from making money and casually getting a buy while, you know, Yemen is bombed. And when it comes to the Israelis, destroy their economy, cut off the ports and prevent them from receiving traffic. And for the America and the UK as well, if they're going to bomb Yemen, no more ships passing through here, you know, action, reaction. That's the only way they learn. That's the only way they learn.
The pound is sinking. The peso's falling. The lira's reeling. Feeling quite appalling. The mark is holding. The franc is fading. For the forest, your father was an extraordinary man, but you don't seem to have inherited many of his mannerisms. Oh, any of his mannerisms. The dollar's moving. Falling, the lira's reeling.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that was Paul McCartney, the man himself, singing The Pound is Sinking from 1982. It's like an album about like economic collapse, which I think is kind of fitting with regard to what Richard Medhurst was talking about there with regard to Israel's economy tanking. Obviously, yeah, that matters. And the other, I want to turn right now actually to another piece of good news that that I talked about briefly last year, and this is this was regard to for a while last year it looked like France and France's allies in West Africa were going to invade Niger after a military coup was basically forcing out the French colonial presence in that region, in that country, in West Africa. You know, really for the first time since Niger actually gained its nominal independence from France in the 1960s. And Niger was looking to reclaim its sovereignty over all its natural resources like uranium and oil and all of that, which had been exploited for decades by Western corporations. And so I talked a bit about that last year. I think I did a whole show on that. But I haven't really talked about it since, and some pretty amazing things have been going on in that whole region. It looks like Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, they're all combining. They've basically formed a confederation at this point, an anti-imperialist confederation, where all three of these countries are combining their forces, combining their resources, and working together very, very closely to basically take back their lands, take back, you know, what was stolen from them by colonialism, by imperialism, and asserting themselves internationally. And it's just really impressive. It's really amazing to see. I mean, this really is Thomas Sankara, the revolutionary leader of Burkina Faso in the 1980s. His dream really was to see this kind of international, you know, all these nations of the region, these formerly colonized nations of the West African region coming together and building an independent future. That was his dream. And that was the dream that he was killed for. So this is really significant, and it's not something that, of course, the Western mainstream media is going to pay any attention to. So Breakthrough News did a really amazing segment on it just this past week. So I want to play that for you right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
We want to turn now to the Sahel, where quite a bit has been happening. If you have missed it, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso have tightened up their alliance, the Alliance of Sahel States, and really formalized it in a major way. And that, well, there's a lot to be said about that. So why don't we just get into it here? We're very honored to be joined once again by Kambale Musavuli, who's an analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo, Kinshasa. Kambale, as always, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you always.
Well, it's great to have you, and maybe let's just start with the recent summit that took place, I believe it was in Niger, of the Alliance of Sahel States, where they tightened up their alliance. I mean, give us a sense of what really happened there and some of at least the initial things you're maybe drawing from the expansion, the cohesion of this Alliance of Sahel States.
I mean, it's a very historic moment to be on the African continent and witness what is unfolding from east to west, where people, no matter the language that they're speaking, they are clearly knowing who the enemy is. And Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso, they are giving us the compass of what needs to be done. These three countries were part of ECOWAS. They were part of many African institutions. And they did not see changes, fundamental changes in the country, especially around security issues. After what people have described as military coups, I said actually the aspiration of the people of the Sahel to change the elite, the bourgeois class that control the country. We saw military leaders take control of the country, and they continue to listen to the voice of the people if you follow very closely. Now, the creation of the Confederation, the Alliance des Etats du Sahel, and their first summit that took place earlier in July, I think it was July 6th that took place, is simply the aspiration of people. And what is it actually? People of Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali have seen for decades instability in the country. As soon as this country created an alliance, they actually seen progress. They see that these so-called jihadists are not able to do the attacks that they have done. They've seen cities controlled by terrorists now in control of the government. So they're seeing concrete progress. The second thing is the control of their wealth, particularly uranium. Well, they saw that they determined the cost of the uranium that was sold in the country by France, and that the uranium leaving the country benefited French people and Europe in general, while inside of Niger, for example, people still didn't have access to electricity. Hmm. Now that they have built the alliance, they are actually working to strengthen the regional cooperation, to use the resources to benefit the people, and to have the security alliance that's going to still protect the people. But the bigger story is not necessarily just the summit. It's what happened after the summit, right? On July 6th, there was a summit that created a confederation of the Sahel alliance of these three countries. But the next day, it was a meeting of ECOWAS, right? Countries met. And when you look at the statement coming out of ECOWAS, it's actually worrisome. The president of Senegal, the new president of Senegal, Diomaye Faye, has been selected as the mediator to work with ECOWAS to find ways to bring back Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso back into ECOWAS. Why I am saying this is problematic? It's problematic because we have not fundamentally addressed the challenge of ECOWAS, the regional body. When you look at these three countries that created a new alliance, they explain clearly why they left. As the founding members of ECOWAS, they saw the inadequacy of ECOWAS to address sovereign decisions of countries, and two, to stop the proliferation of armed groups in the region, and three, that ECOWAS has become the mouthpiece of France, have become a mouthpiece of Western nations. Beyond the statements of the Sahel Alliance, let's just look at ECOWAS meetings. You go to an ECOWAS meeting where you have ECOWAS president sitting, you are seeing the United States government represented in the meeting. You're seeing French diplomats represented in the meeting, and you're asking yourself, is this a meeting of African states, or is this an international meeting with international actors? It becomes confusing. So not addressing the fact that ECOWAS has lost integrity with the people is a problem, right? And Diomaye Faye, who, you know, through the popular mobilization in Senegal. You know, in Senegal, the people of Senegal were very clear that they do not want the former president, Macky Sall, to stay in power. There was grassroots mobilization that brought Diomaye Faye to be president, but his posture at the moment is making all of us question, what is the future of Senegal when Senegal is playing the mediation between the two new body with the new body and the old ECOWAS and the Sahel state, while the people of Burkina Faso, of Mali, of Niger are very clear that their leaders today are sovereign leaders who are making decisions on behalf of the masses of these countries.
I mean, it's really incredible to witness what's taking place, Kambali, and I'm curious if you could touch on how this could possibly pose a challenge to something like AFRICOM as well as ECOWAS.
Specifically for the Sahel Alliance, they're being very clear around the imperialism in the region, and they've defined what they are. From the currency to foreign military bases there, one of them being U.S. military base in Niger, the largest drone base. They have asked these nations, specifically France and the United States, to leave the country. The French soldiers were the first to leave. The United States is leaving up until September. Up until the end of the year, I think all the troops from the United States will be out of Niger. But why are people, not just the government, right, of the Sahel states, why are they calling for these soldiers to leave? One, I do not see a Niger drone base in the United States. Why do we have a U.S. drone base in Niger, right? Two, the security situation of the countries has not improved. So if it hasn't improved, what are these drones doing in the region? So we do know what the drones are doing. The drones are not there for the security of the Sahel. The drones are there for U.S. interest, to protect U.S. interest. Because of that, we see that the people are becoming very clear that if we want security in our country, we need to take control of our destiny. And when you look at the resolutions coming out of the first summit, it's a very amazing document, right? You could sense the spirit of the resolution that speaks about how they are going to have food sovereignty. How are they going to have sovereignty around security? And how are they going to share resources among themselves to strengthen the countries? These are the fundamental of principles of even the creation of ECOWAS or even the creation of the African Union. And these principles have not been applied or enforced. Now you are having states saying, since these old institutions are not implementing that, we are actually going to do that by ourselves. But it's inspiring to see that they have the courage to tell the United States and France that we do not need your military on our land for our security. We use the resources we have and we'll collaborate with nations who respect our sovereignty in the decisions that we are making to provide security to our people.
You know, Kambale, one of the things that's interesting in terms of looking at is looking also at the response of the imperialists who seem to be trying to shift their approach. And I know the French Economic Warfare School, for instance, recently put out a long document about what the future of France is. There are some things that seem to be happening with Cote d'Ivoire and Benin and other countries. So how are we seeing the response of France and the United States? Because obviously their troops are being kicked out, but it's not as if they're just saying, okay, we're giving up here in terms of their attempts to manipulate the politics of Africa.
And it's fascinating, you quote that document, and it's a document that's accessible now vastly online of what the School of Economic Warfare actually published. I mean, can you imagine that France has a school for economic warfare? And when you look at the document, they have clearly determined who's the enemy for France. The enemy of France is not a NATO country. No, it's not a global power. The enemy of France, according to the School of Economic Warfare, is Pan-Africanism. That's very telling, right? That they actually have over a 200-plus page document discussing how Pan-Africanism is a threat to French interests and to France itself. And they've mentioned names of Africans who are actually working for the betterment of Africa. When you see the names, you are confused. You know, why are they the enemy of France? And what they list in the document as danger is that these individuals, these institutions, be it media platforms, be it activists, are raising the consciousness of the African people around French imperialism. What does that mean? And they put it in the document that they've been working for decades to raise the consciousness of the African people, particularly in Francophone Africa, around the use of a currency that they don't control and the fact that the reserves of these countries are found in the Bank of France. How can that be something negative for Africans, right? This is a call for Africans to be sovereign, that we should have our own currency, not a currency controlled by France. So we are clear that France is seeing Pan-Africanism, a particular form of Pan-Africanism as well, right? The left Pan-Africanism, if we have to put it, a Pan-Africanism that's calling for African people to control their land, to control their resources, and to exploit those resources for the benefit, not of the elite, of the entire population. That's the enemy of France. Even if they publish this document, we on the African continent, we know that for Africa to develop, for Africa to be a force in the world of good, we must unite. We might not just unite as the African Union or as ECOWAS. We must unite in a way where we control our land, we control our resources, and we exploit them for the benefit of the masses. We know one body that's doing that. It's the Alliance des États du Sahel, AES, the Sahel Alliance that has been created. And we see that by their actions. We see them by the actions of how these countries are looking into building infrastructure together. That we're seeing how they are saying we are going to exploit the uranium and the oil to benefit the Confederation. We are seeing in the discussion in Burkina Faso around food sovereignty, how we're going to produce agricultural products that will feed our people before we export it. So we see concretely that's the Pan-Africanism that they are pushing for. That's the Pan-Africanism that the vast majority of the African people support. And that is what France is calling the enemy of France. Unfortunately for them, the African youth is clear about Pan-Africanism. This is why from Nairobi to Bamako, all Africans are saying enough and start to the elite who are building for the West, and all power to the people to control our land, to control our resources, to free our people from the bondage and the misery they exist today.
You know, Kambali, that sounds fantastic. I guess the question becomes, you know, the imperialists, they don't take these things lying down. So what are the potential challenges here? I mean, I'm sure there are many, but I mean, just the first couple that come to mind, you know, I can't imagine the US and France are just going to throw their hands up and say, okay, guys, we give up. We're just going to leave this alone and let you do your thing. That's never happened. So what can we expect to see from the reactive side of the imperialist powers?
We're already seeing it. It's going to be a struggle. Let's look at what happened to Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, the AES alliance. You know, they had inhumane sanctions, right? The borders of these countries were probably definitely locked, right? This was a decision of ECOWAS to the influence of Westerns. We also see the accusations from Burkina Faso, from Mali and Niger, that some countries, particularly Côte d'Ivoire, right? Côte d'Ivoire has allowed its soil, and Benin, these two countries have allowed their soil to house so-called terrorists. And not only that, allow French soldiers to actually use the soil for military training and in what they're predicting will be an attack on the Sahel states, right? So, and there will be more and more of these actions. The thing that I think is very insidious, and that's why I brought it up, is the July 7th ECOWAS meeting where the newly elected president of Senegal, Diomaye Faye, has been chosen as the mediator between AES and ECOWAS. That's very insidious because he ran a campaign, they ran a campaign around imperialism. But now that they are in power, you know, they decided not to have radical shifts as we see in AES. They are, they are sharing statements that's worrisome. Just last week, I think on July 15th, the president of Senegal, Diomaye Faye, held a press conference in the presidential palace, discussing with local press about his positions on the region. And one of the journalists asked him directly, what is the position of the president of Senegal vis-a-vis French military in Senegal? Are you saying, one, that they must leave? Or two, if they do not leave, why you are choosing the position? Diomaye Faye didn't respond to the question. He actually did the question. So since July 15th, everyone is questioning what is unfolding in Senegal, whereby the position that they had prior to presidential election is completely different. And of course, there will be more. So when we're speaking about the United States and France, we have to also think about the elite that control the region and how they are going to be used as Africans. It's going to be presented as an African solutions. Africans, mm-hmm. brothers and sisters, to bring one another back into ECOWAS. That's not what the people of this Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso are calling for. They're calling for a radical break with imperialism. So we have to keep an eye out on it. There will be many things happening. It's already happening. But I'm still very confident because of the grassroots of progressive forces in the Sahel for decades to educate the masses around why we must be sovereign and control our own destiny, that no matter what happened in the sub-region, the people will hold the leaders accountable. And for those who are still in the ECOWAS, I'm seeing a trend. Guy Mariusania, the member of parliament for representing Senegal in ECOWAS, he's in the committee for audit. For the past 2 weeks, he's been challenging ECOWAS inside of the ECOWAS parliament. It's fascinating to watch those videos where he's actually asking very basic questions. Why is it that at ECOWAS, that the delegation from Liberia submit an official report about the security situation in Liberia, and in the first sentence of the security situation in Liberia, the enemy of the stability in Liberia, they're saying that it's caused by the influence of communists. That is preposterous. This is the official report of Liberian ECOWAS. The second thing that he has asked is about the influence of foreign institutions into the agenda of building infrastructure in ECOWAS. And the more you follow his action in the ECOWAS parliament, which is now being posted even online, you are noticing people making comments. He should be worried, right? He should be careful. They may kill him. He's saying too much. But we need people who are going to challenge ECOWAS internally. So even inside the ECOWAS, there are many contradictions around how they operate, how they decide for the region, how even the people that they represent do not know the decisions that are being made at the ECOWAS parliament. And thanks to Guy Mariusania of Senegal, we are able to know the situation. So from the Sahel, AES, to those who are still within ECOWAS, everyone is showing the contradiction of ECOWAS being the tool of Western imperialism, and the people are rising up against it, and they will be successful. I believe they will definitely be successful.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kambale Musavuli, analyst with the Center for Research on the Congo, Kinshasa, thank you so much for giving us some of your time here in the Freedom Side.
Thank you always, and see you next time.
Black man, know yourself. your past. Black man, know yourself. Don't forget 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 your past. Black man, black man, black man, a black man. The first university was in Africa. Black Africans were the teachers then. And people came from all over the world to hear the teachings of our ancestors. Later these foreigners begin make war with us, then fight us and enslave us by force, claiming everything of our ancestors. But I said Black Africa will rise back on top.
Black man, know yourself, because he gets our ancestors civilized world. Black man, know
Black man, know yourself, don't forget your past. 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 Black man, 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 don't forget your past.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that was Femi Kuti, son of the famous Afrobeat singer Fela Kuti, and it was Black Man Know Yourself, which I think was a very Pan-African kind of song to sing, you know, which really, really fits with what basically everything that's going on in West Africa right now, where you have resistance, increasingly effective resistance against colonialism there, against empire. And, you know, you have three countries coming together, forming a confederation, three formerly colonized countries, all of them formerly colonized by France. And, you know, you see all the machinations that they're trying to pull to isolate these three countries, trying to put sanctions on them, trying to get the regional, like, allies in Nigeria and Benin and Senegal and stuff to like turn on them and all this sort of stuff. But in the end, it's futile. They can't stamp out the will of the people in that region, as much as they want to pull the strings of corrupt politicians and whatnot. So a bit of Palestine today, a bit of West Africa today. I really didn't want to get into the U.S. electoral politics and stuff. That's just annoying. I might touch on that in a different episode. But today I think I'm going to sign off. I'm going to sign off with a bit of music, and I'm going to see you all here next week. So please stay tuned to CFRU, and please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Solidarity, everyone, and take care, comrades and friends.
The generator's on till the cops said move.